page. We started talking about mazzolas, and I just want to. I've got some extra pages here, so just have a look at this. This is essentially what we did last week, but I just want to go over this a bit, and then I'll give you another page when we've done this. It's the middle section, section B. Ukadoshim b'chol yom yalucha selam. And we said b'chol yom yalucha selam. It's literally halfway down in that paragraph. There's an underlining al Yisrael b'chlav, middle paragraph, and then under that there is heavy print b'chol yom yalucha selam. I raced through this last week, and it really deserves a bit more attention. In the bracha, we say that the kadoshim. Remember, we had a debate: who are the kadoshim? The malachim. Or other kadoshim b'nei Yisrael. I mean, there was a whole debate about that. All right, b'chol yom yalucha sela. Each day they praise you, sela. And the word sela here has got a connotation of meaning constantly, forever. And look what he says over here. Ki ramal kogoyim Hashem. This is the son of the Vilna Gaon. He brings this. He says, because all the psukim that we know, ki ramal kogoyim Hashem. God is above all the nations. All right, mitnei she'ena mitkarvim etzlo. Because they don't draw near to him, as it were, nishar ram me'aleim. He remains elevated above them. Ve'ena miskarev aleim rak al ha'shamayim. So that, as far as the non-Jews are concerned, God is up there in heaven, right? That's the way they describe it. Avol mi kashem elokeinu. Who is like the Lord, our God, our relationship to God? Gam shehu magvi l'shaves. Even though he's hagbah, he's right up there. Mikol makom, nevertheless, what does he do? Hamashpili liros, he comes down to see, ulashkiach aleinu, and he supervises us, looks over us, bashamayim uva ores, in heaven and in earth. Now what does that refer to? Hein b'mazalot hamanagdim lan, and that refers to God's influence over the mazalot which come against us. Now what does mazalot mean? Mazalot are the constellations, the planetary influences which are against us. Now you'll say to me, and we'll talk about this in a second, that Ein Mazal Yisrael, there's a very famous statement, that Israel is not affected by this. It turns out that the Gemara is not so clear about that. All right, and we're going to see this Gemara in a second, but just, let me just finish this section, and then I'll show you this Gemara, which is mind-blowing. It goes like this, Hein b'mazalot hamanagdim lanu. So God, as it were, protects us against those negative forces. Hein neged ha'umot ha'torfim asanu. And also against the nations who are oppressing us. Now it's interesting that little asterisk, I haven't put it on the page in front of you, but what you have at the bottom of the text, the original text, is that he says that who are the ummah, who are the nations who are attacking us? He says it's referring to the ancient nations of Egypt, right? He makes it into a historical thing. There is a real issue with this, and I'll tell you what this is about. In the Mishnah Berurah in Hilchos Shabbos, in Siman Shin Lamed, I think, it's chapter 330. It's either 329 or 330. I'm looking up, but at the moment it's not so important to get the... No, it is important to get the reference, but it's around chapter... I think it's 329, to be precise. The Mishnah Berurah there talks about a halacha of the midwife. And he says that a midwife, a Jewish midwife, and he also talks about a Jewish doctor, quite clearly, he says they should not go and deal with non-Jewish patients on Shabbos. All right, he brings this as a psak halacha. It became a very controversial statement. All right, because obviously, you know, what is he saying? He's saying, and he goes on and talks about Bavon Seinu Harabim that this is a problem because the Jewish doctors go out and they shouldn't go out, right? And of course, he's really talking about the situation in Poland 100 years ago, where the population wasn't exactly sympathetic towards the Jews, and he makes it very difficult halachically for a Jewish doctor to function on Shabbos in that circumstance, right? The modern poskim all say that was a temporary thing, and Rav Yosef brings a whole tshuva on this, and he says nowadays a doctor has to answer the people, it doesn't matter where it's coming from, you don't ask are they Jewish, or they're not, or the phone, whatever it is, you we have in Hashkama, we always have the beeper going off at least three times.
It's a vibrator.
And Adam, what's it, Adam Karp's beeper is always going off the whole time. Middle of a Misha Berach usually, which he's saying. It's quite entertaining. The interesting thing there is that you're looking at Mishnah Berurah, and at the bottom there, he also makes a comment, a note, to say that the nations which he was referring to, or rather the editor of Mishnah Berurah, maybe the Chofetz Chaim himself, he says that it's not referring to the current non-Jews, but it's referring to the non-Jews who lived once upon a time in different countries.
Egypt, Greece, Rome.
Exactly.
All those.
And of course it doesn't mean that. It means the current non-Jewish population.
Yeah,
why did they have to put a note in? Because of the census. If they write in any of their books in the 19th century that something against the Christian authorities, something against the non-Jewish authorities, they are going to generate anti-Semitism
right.
like mad. So this is another example of it. The Mishnah Berurah has it, and it's in a note which is you look in the modern versions of the Mishnah Berurah, and everybody says this note doesn't make sense, because he's clearly talking about the Poles, he's not talking about the Indians, and he's not talking about the Pakistanis and where Jews were living once upon a time in the Far East. He's talking about Poland in the 19th century. All right? And here also, when he says Negida Umos, and the note says it means the ancient Egyptians, he's not talking about the ancient Egyptians, he's talking about the non-Jews in Lithuania in the 1800s who were attacking Jews. But they always covered their tracks. They had to, because of censorship. And it's a very interesting thing that they were so sensitive when they wrote something about the non-Jewish world, they had to preface it, or they had to almost disguise the wording that they used.
That's why they took out Shehem, Palom, Lehevov, Olarim.
And that's the greatest one, right? And of course, if you look at the Olenu, that's the ultimate example, because there's a line missing. And you know there's a line missing, because the bit, he's put it back in brackets, but if you think about it, the line that they put back in makes sense, because it gets to the point. Shalosam Chokeno Gohem, Go Olenu Kolam Onam. All right, our portion is not really amongst them. And then, va'anachnu karim, and we bow down. Now, the context doesn't really follow. It's va'anachnu, and we do something, implying that in the previous sentence, they do something, which is X, and we do something, which is Y. We bow down to God. What do they do? But it doesn't say, right? But if you add in the phrase which was missed out, shehei mishtachmim lehevav arit, that they bow down to nothingness, right? Mispalim al Yeshua, and they pray to a God who won't save them. And of course, Yeshua is a play on the Yeshu, right? That's the whole thing. Then, if you see that, then you realize that phrase fits into the Alayna brilliantly. Because it says, they do this, va'anachnu karim, and we do something else. But this was missed out because of the sense.
They say that Yeshua.
And of course, that's the great question, that it really was written by Yeshua originally, but you can always argue that this extra phrase is obviously about Avodah Zorah. It's not about Jesus per se, but of course you can read Jesus into it, right? And that's really what the Christians did. We can argue, look, this passage doesn't actually refer to Christianity. It refers to any foreign god who you claim to be a savior. All right, the fact that it's got this kind of linguistic reference to Yeshua was really their problem. All right, you know what Yeshua? Yud Shin Vav, Yemach Shemo V'Zikro. You know, that's what actually stands for, without being too polite about it. That was the abbreviation. His real name was Yeshua, but they kind of abbreviated it for obvious reasons. There was no punches pulled on that one. A lot of interesting stuff over here. So basically, again, we're looking at the same thing, that when you get any reference to the non-Jewish world, what happens is that it gets covered up. It gets, what's the word, anesthetized, if that's the right word. I don't know if you say that in America. You don't have an anesthetist.
Yeah.
You have an anesthesiologist here, but in England you have an anesthetist. That's the same thing. And you anesthetize. It becomes packaged in a way that it's not going to offend anybody. So they always put a little note. In case the censor sees this thing, that God is protecting us from the umot, hatorfot, the nations who are torfimotan, who are ripping us apart. It's not referring to the current Lithuanian thugs and the Cossacks, but it's referring to the ancient Egyptians, all right? And that's why you've got this little note over here. That's just purely an aside. So all of this, he's saying, is what God does. V'zeu kadoshim b'nei Avraham b'chol yom mistakrim mashkechos. And what does it mean, kadoshim? Meaning the b'nei Yisrael, the b'nei Avraham, they mistakrim mashkechos aleihem, they look at his supervision, v'pratut, carefully, b'erev, b'boker, b'tzarayim, three times a day. Al Kain, and because they realized that without the protection of God we would be nowhere, Yalalucha Sela Perusha Kolaya, we praise God the whole time. So this bracha is a bracha about Jewish survival. It's an interesting thing. It turns out that we recognize that God's hand in our survival is so crucial. Hein Bashamaya Vahein Ba'aret. He protects us from the heavenly negative forces known as Mazalot, and he protects us from the earthly negative forces known as the nations of the world who are out to get us. And this has been the history of the Jewish people for the last 3,500 years. He says, Ki b'chol yom, what does it mean all day? Perusha yom lo neda, there's no day which is missing. And v'sela kavanoso kol hayom, the whole day, every day. This is the protection of God. Me'erev avokev etzorayim, morning, evening, or evening, morning, and afternoon. Miloshon mesila asher soluba b'nei adam. This is, sela comes from the expression mesila. Mesila means a line. It means like a railway line, right? A track which people walk along. Kol hayom v'chosha, all day and all time. Upirish alalucha tirav upirish yishtabach, which we don't have. I looked for his explanation on yishtabach and I haven't got it. So there's obviously a bit more of a manuscript to find. Somewhere in Lithuania there must be a manuscript somewhere of the continuation of his perish. His perish that we have starts after yishtabach. So that's an interesting thing. Somebody should go and see if they can find it. The Babich Rebbe had tons of books which the Russians confiscated. I don't know if they ever got that library back. They might have got bits of it back, but not the whole thing. So these libraries are still in Russia somewhere. So maybe this manuscript is there. I don't know. The bottom line of what he's saying, again, is that what are we doing every day? We are praising God for his continual protection, hein b'shamayim v'hein b'aretz, whether it be in heaven or whether it be on the earth. What is in heaven? He says the mazalot. Now listen, have a look at this. If you've never seen this Gemara, this is something which really can disturb you for the rest of the week, but this is the way it is. I'll preface this with a little story. The story goes like this, that in 1194, you've got another one there? Yeah? Okay. In 1194, what happened was, this was about 100 years after the Crusades began, what happened was that the Rambam was obviously, you know, one of the major authorities in the Jewish world. And the Crusades have been going on for nearly 100 years. It started in 1096. And by 1194, the Jewish communities in France and Germany had suffered terribly. And what happened was that there was a movement amongst many Rabbonim to say, look, we're going through these Chevle Mashiach, right, which is the way they saw it. And therefore, what we have to do is to predict, start saying, when is Mashiach coming? And they started making astrological predictions, according to the Mazalot. And we'll see what that's all about in a second. And it's so fascinating. They predicted Mashiach was coming on a Tuesday afternoon in the year 1193, in June or whatever Hebrew date it was, right? And they kept doing this, and of course the day went past, and it went past, and it went past, and it didn't happen. And eventually what happened was, one of these guys wrote to the Rambam, and they said, Rabbi Maimon, can you please help us with this particular quest? We were trying to work out, according to astrology, when the Mashiach is coming. And he wrote back to them, and he gave them a blast. He said, basically, as far as I'm concerned, astrology is nonsense. It's not a science. It's got no basis I wouldn't say in Torah, but it's got no basis in rational thought. Remember, the Rambam was a rationalist. Everything had to make sense. And he said, what you've got to do is you've got to daven, and you've got to, you know, he basically gave him a drasha. And it was a letter from the Jews in Marseille. If you want to read it, I haven't got the text here, but if you want to look at it, there is a copy of the Rambam's letters put out by Isidore Twersky, and I presume he's the same connection as all the other Twersky. It's a green cover book, which a lot of people might have at home. It was brought out about, must have been 25, 30 years ago at least. And it's got all the letters of the Rambam. This one is very fascinating. And what does the Rambam do with this Gemara? And the Rambam says that the Gemara that we're just about to read together is actually not to be taken literally. Now listen to this. I'm sorry, the print is very tiny. I took this. There is a wonderful collection of Ein Yaakov, all in one volume. The Ein Yaakov, you know, was the it was a favorite sefer to learn. It was all the Agadot of the Gemara, and it was all put together in four volumes originally. And it used to be in Europe was the shir after Mara was always Ein Yaakov, because the Balabatim, when they're sitting there, you know, to give them a heavy Baba Kama shir, they'd all be asleep, because they worked so hard in those days. So what do? You give them Ein Yaakov, the story, and then everybody came awake. You know, when this one did this, and this one flew in the air, and this one did that. You know, the Gemara says, how do you make yourself invisible? And everyone's like, oh, that's interesting. You know, it kept you awake. So all this sort of thing, you know, the Gemara talks about. This is a classic. Listen, I produced it in English because I think it'll just go a bit quicker. It was written in Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi's notebook. All right? They obviously found this after he died. I was amused at this because my Rosh Hashiva had a notebook. Every good Rosh Hashiva has a little black book which he has in his vest. And that little black book has a whole bunch of phone numbers in it, usually for shidduchim purposes. I'm just giving away a secret. It's either Shidduchim, or the story about Rebbe Lopium was that he had a little black book from his earliest, from Bar Mitzvah, in which he wrote down all his Averis. He used to make a little note of things that he wasted 5 minutes here, and he did this there, and people found the book afterwards, and he found about 3 pages written, right? But it all had little, like, hieroglyphics. I don't think we could do it as a black book these days, but unbelievable story. And the family found this book, and they then realized what it was, and it's kind of a, you know, it's in the family somewhere. One of them has it, some of them has it. And, well, you could do this with a palm pilot. The little black book, but it's famous. The Gates of Rosh Hashanah used to have it for Shidduchim purposes. He used to sort of pull out his book and say, you know, I can match this one and that one. And he used to do it, and he made a lot of Shidduchim. Every good Rosh Hashanah needs a little black book. So he says like this, it is written in Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi's notebook. If a person was born on a Sunday, Sunday's child, right? There's a whole poem about this. He will be completely of one type, and there will be nothing of another type in him. So the Gemara says, what do you mean? There will be nothing of another type. Do you mean that a person born on a Sunday is completely evil, and there's no virtue in such a person? Is that really what you're saying? But Rav Ashi said, I was born on a Sunday. Rav Ashi was a tzaddik. Okay. Therefore, you must say that it is not a trace of evil, that there is no trace of evil in somebody born on a Sunday. So you're born on a Sunday, that's good news. You're going to be up in the tzaddik's league, all right? But Rav Ashi said, I am Dimi ben Kakuzer. And this Dimi was not exactly one of the holy men of the world. Right? We're both born on a Sunday. I'm the Rosh Yeshiva, and he's the leader of the gangsters in the town. He's the local mafiosi. And we're both born on the same day. So how do you explain that? This being so, you cannot say that all persons born on Sunday are good. Because this evil Bar Kakuzra, Kakuzda was born on a Sunday. Neither can you say that all are bad, because Rav Ashi was born on a Sunday. So how do you understand what's going on? Says the Gemara, it means that a person who's born on a Sunday is either completely, typical Gemara, either completely virtuous or completely wicked. It's either all or nothing, all right? You're either going to be a big tzaddik or you're going to be a big rasha. I find so amazing that the Gemara preserves the names of not only the tzaddikim, but also the rishayim. You know, there's a law on Shabbos which defines cooking according to a bandit who used to cook, a guy called the name's gone out of my head completely. Not Bar Keturah, but it was something like that. Not Ben Keturah, what was his name? Ben Drusoy. We don't know his first name, right? Unless his first name was Ben. May have been Ben. I don't know. Ben Drusoy. And what Ben Drusoy used to do is that he was so busy robbing. He was like, in England, there's a legend called something called Dick Turpin. I've never heard of it.
Oh, yes.
And you heard of Dick Turpin, right? And it was a guy who used to rob, not the
highwayman.
Rich. He didn't, not like Robin Hood to feed the poor, it was to feed himself. He was the highwayman. And you had somebody in the Talmud, the same profession. And it says that he used to eat his meals on the run because he was always robbing. And Halacha says that if you cook something on Shabbos, the amount that this Ben Drusoy would be able to eat it, that's called halachically cooked on Shabbos. And that's an unbelievable statement. Because we're taking a guy who really was not noteworthy in our history, right, as an example for the definition of cooking on Shabbos. It's an incredible thing. And the same thing over here. And it was a third, according to one opinion, a third or one opinion and a half. And the rabbi said, what does that mean? Does it mean in quality, or does it mean in time? Right? Because it might be a third, meaning if it takes an hour, 20 minutes. All right? Which may be less edible than a third in quality, if you see what I mean. You might need to cook a bit more to get a third cooked. I'm not sure. There's a whole machlokes about it. But what is so interesting is that the Gemara is prepared to perpetuate the names of these very suspicious characters for the sake of learning. And I think this is really something else. So again, Sunday's child is going to be either good or bad. Let's just go after the brackets. The person is born on a Monday, see it's underlined. He'll be a bad-tempered person. This, of course, now you're going to go home and start checking out when you were born. What day of the week? I haven't got a clue. You know you're born on Shabbos. Okay, Shabbos is good. I'm not sure about the rest of the days. So I've got to go home. I really don't know. I'm not sure. I've got to look at my birth certificate. I think I have to go back to that. Monday's going to be bad-tempered, right? Why is this so? Because, again, what am I telling you here is something remarkable. Because what has Monday got to do with anything? What has Sunday got to do with anything? But look what it says. Why is Monday bad-tempered? Because the waters were divided on Monday, second day of creation. They would be at odds with everyone. Person born on Tuesday will be wealthy and promiscuous. Interesting combination. Why? Because herbs were created on Tuesday, third day of creation. Herbs grow quickly and intermingle indiscriminately. So you'll have a lot of money, but you'll be a bit of a playboy at the same time. Okay, it might explain a lot. If a person's born on a Wednesday, he'll be wise and have a good memory. Okay, Wednesday's good. Why? Because on Wednesday, the fourth day of creation, the luminaries were set in the sky, and it says, Torah is a light. Okay? Nemitz of the Torah. All right. On Thursday...
Well,
there you go. It's an interesting Gemara. If you've never seen this, it's unbelievable. If a person is born on a Thursday, he'll be kind to others. Why? Because on Thursday, the fifth day of creation, the fishes and the birds were created through God's loving kindness. They find their food effortlessly. If you're born on a Friday, you'll be a seeker. All right? Now, I'm not sure what exactly that means, a seeker. Meaning somebody's always looking for something, presumably. All right? Remember the Seekers? They were good in the 1960s. They were excellent band. Remember them well. All right? Rabbi Nachman Bar Yitzchak, I suppose it is, explain. A seeker after mitzvahs. Just as on Erev Shabbos, everyone seeks to make the necessary preparation for Shabbos. Good. Whenever you're born on Shabbos, we'll die on Shabbos, right? It seems to be around a package deal. Because the Shabbos was desecrated in order to bring him into the world, although this is permitted and this is a mitzvah. Rabbi Bashila said, a person born on Shabbos will be called a very holy person. Not everyone born on Shabbos will die on Shabbos, but if someone was born and died on that on Shabbat, it is a sign that he was a very saintly person. And I think we have examples of that in history. I mean, Governor Melech, presumably, although I'm not sure it was a Shabbos.
No, but it was
Moses Shabbos. Moses Shabbos. All right. That's Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi's little notebook. An interesting little notebook indeed. All right? What's he talking about? I don't really know. Rabbi Hanina said to his disciples, go and tell Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, in whose above-mentioned notebook were written the character traits of people who are born each day of the week. It is not the constellation of the day of the birth that influences a person's life, but the hour in which he was born. This is astrology, full blast. They all seem to say either it's the day of the week or it's the time of the day. All right, and this is what's happening. There are seven celestial bodies, the sun, the moon, the five planets. In those days, they hadn't discovered the other couple of planets. And every hour, another one is dominant over the others. A person born at the hour when the sun is dominant will be a bright man. He will eat and drink of his own, not take away anyone's food or drink like the sun does not encroach on the moon. His secrets will be known to all like the sun that shines for everyone to see. And if he is a thief, he will not be successful because the sun does not steal. It shines in the daytime, not at nighttime. A person born under Venus will be wealthy and promiscuous. This is, seems to be... So if it's Wednesday and Venus, then you really had it. Tuesday and Venus, excuse me. Why? Because Venus is the planet of fire, denotes passion. A person born under Mercury will be wise and have a good memory. Good. Why? Because the planet Mercury is the scribe of the sun, closest to the sun, and records all the orbit of the sun. Fine. A person born under the influence of the moon will suffer a great deal. It will build and dismantle and build. Just like the moon, because the moon grows and then the moon... disappears and grows again. He will eat and drink that which is not his, like the moon that's sometimes seen in the daytime, and the secret remain hidden like the moon, that is actually dark, since it does not have light of its own. If he is a thief, he will be successful like the moon, that the sun takes the sun's light and makes it his own. A person born under Saturn will be a man whose plans are thwarted, because Saturn is Shabta, which means to frustrate. Others say all evil plots against him will be thwarted, will be nullified. A person born under Jupiter, which is called Sedek in Hebrew, will be a tzaddik, a righteous person. But Nachum Bar Yitzchak said he will be a charitable person. All right? A person born under Mars will be spilling blood. And of course, this is famous. If you're born under the sign of Mars, what should you do with your life? Rav Ashi said, having free will is going to choose. You will either be a surgeon, literally a bloodletter, a robber, a butcher, or a moil. What a choice. It's a pretty frightening combination. Moil and doctors, of course, do go together very, very well. Rabba said, I was born under Mars, and I don't do any of these things. Replied Abaya, you too shed blood, for as a judge you punish people and have them executed, which is again very interesting. Alright? Now, all of that so far seems to suggest it depends on the day and it depends on the hour. Alright? Mazalot. This is, and I always remember walking into the shul I done in London, it had a ceiling motif, which you don't see in many shuls anywhere in the world, which was the mazalot. You have the Torah mazalot on the ceiling.
And I always thought if you believed in them, it was like a
vote of like unbelievable, it was in the shul. And you see it in the machzorin in Tfilas, it's either one or the other, probably both. Geshem and Tfilas Tal. If you open up the machzor at the back, it's even in the article, they've got the 12 mazalot as one of these long tefillahs which nobody ever says, or nobody says today. They probably used to say a very long tefillah, which seems to say that according to the mazal or whatever it is, for whatever month, we... expect the month to produce a certain amount of rain or a certain amount of dew, depending on the definition of what the mazal is. So we've got this theme in Jewish life of mazalot. And of course this is very disturbing because the basic question is, what about hashgacha? We've just said in our commentary that what does God do? God goes against the mazalot. And yet we're saying over here that we've got an influence of Mazalot. We've got an influence of heavenly constellations, either the day that you were born or the hour that you were born. And this is an influence. There was a radio show in London a few years ago where they had an astrologer who would take phone calls, and he wouldn't ask for your name. He would just ask for the day and the time that you were born. And you heard a rustling of paper. Now, whether he was just rustling some papers around, you know, just to make for the sound effect. Because it was on radio, right? You didn't know what he was doing. And the next thing he says, well, I can tell you the following. And then he would start telling all the things that, according to his charts, happened to this person in his life. And the number of times that the person would say, how did you know that? Well, that's incredible. How did you really know that? It would go on and on like this, and it would be more than... You think to yourself, has he set this up? Has he actually, you know, done something here which is like a, you call it in Gemara, knunya, right? A bit of a schwindel here. What is going on? Is it for real? And this program went on for years, it was. There was an astrologer on the show, and it was a phone-in show. And you wanted your prediction, right? For whatever purpose, you would say, what purpose you wanted it for. And there seems to be, I don't know whether you can do a course in this in NYU, I'm not sure, but there seems to be astrology is recognized as something which is in existence for sure, and it has a certain car. Now the question is, what do we do with it? Because if we now are saying that we are doubling to Hashem, to go against this, what is all this Gemara talking about when the rabbis say, you're born under this star, you're born under that sign, under this time of the day? It doesn't follow. And this is really what the next part of the Gemara says. Listen to this. We have learned. Rabbi Chanina says, the constellations at a person's birth make him wise, make him wealthy. And Israel's destiny is determined by the stars. All right? Which is, of course, against what we just learned in our commentary. Says Rabbi Yochanan, Israel can change the influence of the stars for the better through prayer and good deeds. Rabbi Yochanan is consistent with his view. Rabbi Yochanan said, how do you know that Israel's destiny is not determined by the stars? Ein mazal Yisrael. Because it says, thus said God, do not learn to go the way of the nations, and do not be dismayed by the portents in the sky, lest the measure be dismayed by them, etc. They are dismayed, but not Israel, because Israel could overcome planetary influence by prayer and doing mitzvahs. The answer to the question is that the influence of these things, astrological influence, does exist, but we can rise above it. If we daven and we pray to Hashem, Kedoshim b'chol yom yalalucha selah, that's what we say in the davening every day, we are asking God to help us to go above those influences. And you'll say to me, when are those influences really influencing, right? When can they affect you? And you'll see over here, he brings a whole thing. I'm not going to go through the whole Gemara over here, but if you just turn over, you'll see that, hang on, where does it start? We'll start at the bottom paragraph. Sorry, on the same page at the bottom. From Shmuel, we can also learn that Israel is not susceptible to the influences of the planets. Listen to this. For Shmuel and a Gentile astrologer named Avlat were sitting together while certain people passed on the way to a swamp. What they were doing going down to the swamp, I'm not quite sure. But whatever it was. Said Avlat to Shmuel, that man is going to the swamp. He'll never come back because a snake will bite him and he's going to die. That was a kind of very friendly prediction, right? That guy... he's out of here. He's shuffled off his mortal coin. If he's a Jew, said Shmuel, he will go and come back. While they were sitting there, the man went to the swamp and he came back. Of course, the prediction was overturned. All right? Seeing this, Avlat got up, threw down the man's knapsack, and found in it a snake, goodness gracious, that was cut into two pieces. Said Shmuel to the man who was saved, even though he was destined to die, what good deed did you do to deserve it? In other words, you must have done an act of chesed or something, otherwise you would have died. So the man said, the man replied, I'm with a group of people, and every day we placed our bread in a basket, and then we ate together. But today one of us had no bread, and he was ashamed. So I told my friends, let's collect the bread into the basket. When I came to him, I pretended to take the bread from him, but I really put in my own share, so that we should all not be embarrassed. You did a mitzvah, said Shmuel to him. That's why you were saved. Thereupon Shmuel went out and expounded, charity saves a person from death. Stokotatsum emoves, not only will it save him from an unnatural death, but also from a natural death. What we're saying is that these predictions can be overcome through spiritual pursuit, through Torah, through tefillah, through tzedakah, through whatever it may be. You can overcome the negativity of the astrological prediction. The next story is the most famous story of Rabbi Akiva. From Rabbi Akiva, we learn that Israel is not subject to astral influences. By the way, now next time you wish somebody mazel tov, you just got to think about what you're saying. You're saying mazel tov, may the astral influence be good, right? Which is what you're saying when you wish somebody mazel tov. In other words, what does tov mean in this case? That may your merit go above any negativity which may be there in the mazal which you may have at this time. Because we see mazalot as having positive effect, but it can also have a negative effect. So the tov is qualifying the mazal, that the mazal which you are experiencing at this time should be only for the good and for nothing else. Now this is very weird. And if you actually explain that to most people, they probably would stop saying mazal tov and start inventing another phrase to use. I really don't know. And it's come into Judaism, we all do it, and we all do it with a great gusto and a passion, and it's weird. It's very strange. It's this whole area of superstition of, and we believe, well, some of us believe in that stuff, and I don't know, you name it, you know, you go to your bobbies and you see what they used to do in Europe. Right? I once went to a Brit in London, and it was a family who had roots from Transylvania, of all places. It was a big Jewish community, Romania, and there was garlic in the window, and I said to them, garlic is going to hang on one second. That the effect of this stuff is going to counteract any ruach ra. And a ruach ra is again a theme in halacha. Why do we wash our hands every day? All right, we wash our hands every day because of something called ruach ra. The halacha says not for cleanliness when you wake up in the morning, and we do it three times. We do it sirugin, which is different to the way that you wash your hands by motzi. All right, and the only other time you do it like that is when you leave a cemetery. You're supposed to wash your hands three times in the same way that you do negavasa because of ruach ra. Right? There are ruchot in the cemetery. Look in the Gemara in Brachos in the, what was it, second paragraph. There's a whole story there about people spending evenings in the cemetery listening to what was going on. There were lots of sounds and weird stuff going on. I don't know. One of my experiences, which I'll never forget, when I took a group of students to visit concentration camps. You go and visit Treblinka. Treblinka is the most frightening place you ever go to because there's nothing there. It's a big opening in a forest, if you've ever been there, and if you've seen it. And there's nothing there, because what the Nazis were going to do is kill the Jews and then completely destroy the evidence. So all you have there is a mass grave. And one of my students took a picture. It was twilight time. And he showed me the picture back in London afterwards, and there's a white film over this picture. It looks like a ghost. And he said to me, this is kind of weird, because he said, did I feel that this was a place where there were ruchot, there were spirits flying around, there was a lot of unsettled business there, spiritual stuff. You feel it. When you go there, there's not a bird flying over the whole place. Now, the same in Auschwitz, you don't see any birds flying over the whole place, because there's like, you know, you feel that there are neshamas there which just haven't settled. You know, for whatever, obviously, you know, for the terrible things going on there, it's unbelievable. It's really spooky, and we've got this element, we've got this theme in Jewish life, the idea of ruach ra. Got this, it comes out in halacha. We've got amulets, we've got this idea of kamiyas, right? Dibbuk, which is another thing. There is a tradition. There's a rav in London. His grandfather was involved with a dibbuk, actually an exorcism, and he performed this operation, if you want to call it that, in Europe. Now, are they doing exorcism in Israel today? I bet you they are. I bet you there are certain rabbonim who advertise that they would do this for you. Nowadays we call it manic depression, and we call it schizophrenia, and we send people to psychiatrists and psychologists and doctors, and they get drugs and whatever, the split personality. But in Europe they call it a dibbuk. All right? Now, who's right? I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm not an expert in one thing or the other, thank goodness. And all of this is in the melting pot of what we would call folklore, Jewish folklore. This is not, and it comes out in halacha. The halacha is clear on Shabbos about wearing a kamiya. Are you allowed to wear a kamiya? Is it called carrying on Shabbos? All right, I think the halacha says you're allowed to wear it. All right, for a lot of reasons. Number one, because you've got a kamiya in order to help, for health reasons usually. And it's worn like an ornament. So the same way you can wear a brooch, a woman can, or you can wear a watch or whatever, you can wear a kamiya on Shabbos. And the halacha mentions this. So all the time, all of this stuff is there in Jewish life. All right, the mazalot, the whole theme of this. Give one more example, the Gemara in Baba Basra, which is my favorite. It's talking about two gardens next to each other. Garden A is looking as if it's something out of the Botanical Gardens of New York. Garden B is looking out of a film set of a Vietnam War movie, right? And the two gardens are one next to the other. And the two owners are discussing about putting a fence down the middle. And the Gemara says that owner of the beautiful garden can force, literally take him to basement, the other guy to chip in to pay for the fence. All right? And the reason is, the Gemara says, because the guy who owns the midbar over there is going to look over to the guy who has the beautiful garden and put an iron horror on the whole thing. And once he puts an iron horror on it, that's it. The botanical garden becomes a disaster zone. And therefore, to avoid the iron horror, and this is the first page of Gemara Baba Basra, the Gemara says what you do is you jointly build a fence. So again, what are we talking about? We're talking about a halachic application of a very non-halachic concept, the concept of ayin hara, right? Our bobbies knew about this because they would use the word, say, kamein hara, wherever you went, yeah. Right? There was nothing that would happen in Jewish life where they would not preface the statement with kan ayin hara, li ayin hara, right? And they understood this. Where does the ayin hara come from? Look in the Jewish Encyclopedia, and you'll see that it's got roots in ancient Babylon and ancient, I know, you name it. Everybody had this kind of evil eye concept, and it's big in Jewish life.
That's right, because I studied things, and the Gemara talks about the fact that the Bnei Yosef were not subject to the Ayin Hara.
They were not subject.
So obviously there is a very strong belief in Ayin Hara.
There's this total acceptance, and again, it's all part of the same genre of what we're learning over here. And it's part of the parish which we saw on Kadoshim B'chol Yom Aluch HaSela. What is happening is that we realize that we need the Yad Hashem, the Ashgacha of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to help us against the enemy down here and the enemy up there. Who's the enemy up there? The Mazalot. All right? There is something in those forces which can really affect us. How they get switched on to affect us, that we're not really told. Listen to this story, Rabbi Akiva. If you don't know this story, it's a fabulous story. And for Rabbi Akiva, also learn, Israel is not subject to astral influences. How do we know? Rabbi Akiva had a daughter. The astrologers told Rabbi Akiva, on the day she will go under the bridal canopy, a snake will bite her, and she will die. What happened was, Rabbi Akiva was walking down the street, and he met an astrologer. All right? And the guy said, "Oh, Rabbi Akiva, I've got some great news for you." And Rabbi Akiva said, "I don't want to hear it," but the man insisted. It was known as a choldir. Okay? Obviously, he had it in for the rabbi. And he said, "Rabbi, you should know that when your daughter gets married, on the day she gets married, she's going to die." Right? That's a very pleasant thing. And then he walked off. So Rabbi Akiva, 20 years, he was at Sitri. He thought that this was really going to happen. It's an unbelievable thing. Rabbi Akiva was very worried about this. He, nonetheless, for 20 years, she got married. Presumably she was, I don't know, 19, 20, whatever she was. 20 years, he's worried about this prediction. Listen to this. On her wedding day, she took her brooch and stuck it into the wall. They used to keep things in holes in the wall, as opposed to a cabin or whatever. They would have these little cubby holes or whatever. It happened that the needle of her brooch landed in the eye of a snake and killed it. All right? Very useful sort of thing to do, but she didn't realize what she was doing. The next morning, she pulled the brooch out of the wall. The snake came out at the end of the needle. Dead, obviously. So, of course, Rabbi Akiva, you know, he plutzed, right? "What did you do to deserve this miracle?" her father asked. "Last night," she said, "a poor man came to the door." She replied, "Everyone was busy preparing the wedding banquet. Nobody was able to hear the poor man knocking on the door. So I got up and gave him a portion that was given to me and gave it to the poor man." "You did a mitzvah," said Rabbi Akiva. Therefore, Rabbi Akiva went out and said, "Charity saves tzedakah tatzum imoves, not only from an unnatural death, but also from a natural death." Phenomenal story. And again, it's the same thing. I'll tell you where this came up in school. This happened in England. I haven't had this problem in America, but the British kids seem to be into this. They were experimenting with a lot of this kind of very borderline, I wouldn't even call it black magic, but they were trying things. There's something called a Ouija board. I don't know if you come across
that. Yeah.
And it was something which, I don't know how you set it up. And one of my students, he said that we were doing this at the weekend, and he came up with some very weird and wonderful predictions. Should I be worried about it? All right? You know, I said, should have asked me before you did it, right? Because now that you've done it, you've got a bit of a problem. And I explained to him that according to this Gemara, there are two stages. Stage number one is Ein Mazal Yisrael. Have nothing to do with it. All right? If you ignore it, if you have nothing to do with it, it has nothing to do with you. And this is what we say, Kadoshim b'chol yom l'chasela, God protects us from it, keeps away from us, right? Stage two is if we involve ourselves with this stuff. If you fancy stopping off at the palm reader on 72nd Street and 1st Avenue and go in there, whatever, wherever the address is, there's about a million of them around Manhattan, and you ask for a prediction, then you've got to be prepared for the consequences of that prediction. That's what I think is really going on here. The Gemara says Rabbi Akiva didn't ask for this prediction, but when he got the prediction, what did he do? He worried about it for 20 years. He never ever forgot the prediction was coming, and he lost sleep over it. And the only reason why you could go above it was because of a mitzvah, because of an act of kindness or whatever it was, which saved his daughter from the prediction actually taking place. In other words, the mazal can affect you. And that, of course, I think is why the phrase mazal tov is
used.
If
you believe in it.
If you believe in it. And what is happening is that what we're doing, mazal tov, I suppose, is saying that what we want when a happy event takes place is that we want no... put it this way, we don't want mazal to have any influence negatively, and whatever connection we have to it, it should be tov. Anything that comes out of this should be good. If it's going to be a mazal which is going to go against what we're doing, then let's turn it into something which is good through an act of chesed, through kindness or whatever, through the mitzvah that we're about to perform. Because mazal tov is usually expressed at a time of mitzvah, all right? A wedding, an engagement, at a bar mitzvah, at a bris, whatever it is. This is when we use the phrase mazal tov, all right? I suppose nowadays we kind of extend it to passing examinations. Maybe a mitzvah in terms of parnasa. You know what I'm saying? You can link all of these ideas into the same melting pot of this gray area in Judaism which says that we really don't believe in this, but if we come across it, we've got to be worried about it. And it's very strange. It's really something weird. It's a theme in Talmud. It's a theme in medieval literature, and it's even a theme today. And what is so worrying, as I said at the beginning, is that it's coming back in Israel all over again. There are people now who are established as, I wouldn't say the soothsayers, they're not going in for that stuff, but they're going in for these, let's call them these ancient remedies, right? Some of which maybe are effective. I'm not saying they're not effective. But what do? They become very, I don't know what the word is, it's disturbing. It's disturbing because we're delving into something which is almost like bringing this type of situation upon ourselves. Should we really be dabbling in those areas? And I'm not sure. And you can get this in Sfat, you'll get this in Yerushalayim, you'll get this
in... Going for a bracha or something like
going
that,
for a bracha.
Sitting on this chair and that'll bring...
this is the, and all of this is really,
but are you really
a problem.
Are you really allowed to do that?
No, that's the point. All of this is a question of how far can we put this, you know, these influences into sort of the human realm, into the human sphere. I really don't know. I'm not sure about this. I know that there is the concept of the Rebbe's bracha, but the Rebbe being a conduit from God to the human being. All right, so I'm happy with the Rebbe's bracha. We read it with Yitzchak. Why did Yitzchak want food with the story of the brachas? Because he wanted to convey a bracha through the material. You can convey something spiritual. That's the concept of Yitzchak having the food before giving a bracha. Right, and that became the stereotype for the Rebbe. The Rebbe breaks the bread, and then you know, pandemonium, and they all sort of pull the bread apart, and all the Hasidim go berserk. And this is basically what happens to this very day. What we are talking about is the more fringe elements, and these fringe elements. And I heard somebody a few weeks ago. They told me that they heard about it in Israel. As I mentioned, the bunkers, the kosot, people are doing this. And there are women who claim this will cure anything. All right, I believe it or not, I had a neighbor in Israel. I'll tell you a really frightening story. She went through a pregnancy. I think it was called ectopic. Ectopic is when it's outside the womb, right? It's in the tubes. And at the time, she didn't know what was going on. And what did she do? Rather than going to her doctor, this was 15 years ago. Rather than going to her doctor straight away, she went to one of these faith healers, because this is really what they are. And she did the bunkers. She did this thing with the bunkers. This woman was really in great danger of losing her life. All right. She then, after doing this, realized that it didn't help her at all. She went to see a doctor. She was in and out of the hospital within 24 hours with a whatever the procedure is called, and that was it. And thank God she was alive to tell the story. But what was so frightening was that people are seeing this as, you know, Tachana Merkazit. This is the central station again. Not to go to regular medicine, but to go back to all of these weird and wonderful things. The Gemara says it's all there. It's all part of our tradition. But again, we've got to be, as it were, very careful with the same thing like mazal. Do we really bring it upon us? No. We don't look for it. We don't actually want to go in for it. And you can see Rabbi Kiva said, the final story over here again, Ein mazal Yisrael. There's a whole story about Rabbi Nachman, also a famous story. Whichever way you look at this, the reality is that this is an area which has always been around, and it's an area which we are very, very, what's the word, reluctant. We're not so keen on it. Except when it comes to one thing, when it comes to a simcha, we all wish each other mazal tov, and we bring mazalot into the picture. And that's always been something, you know, once I went through some of this material, I realized I really don't understand why that has happened. Unless you say that by doing, mentioning mazal in a tov, in a good setting, what are you doing? You're cancelling out any negative effect that the mazal might have in that situation. All right? That person, or that simcha, or that couple, or that bris, or that bar mitzvah, whatever it may be, should turn into something tov, should turn into something good, whatever it may be. This is very strange. It's the gray area of Yiddishkeit. No question in my mind about this. Superstitions.
Like a Vachnacht and a Red Bendel and all this.
And we do a lot of this stuff. We're doing this all the time.
And
the schoolers as well.
We're very, very,
let's put it this way, we've got to be very careful with all of this. The story from Rabbi Akiva really sets it out. The story from Rabbi Akiva says that if it comes your way and it becomes part of your life, you've got to deal with it. Right? Rabbi Akiva was dealing with what happened to him. But if it doesn't come your way, don't go looking for it. Don't go looking for this kind of fringe thing, because it is fringe. It's there. It's a koach in the teva. And I think these things are really kochos in the teva. And they are there, but we've got to be so careful. You look in Tanakh, chapter 28 of Shmuel Aleph, the story of the witch of Endor, and you'll see what's going on there. Shaul is desperate. Only an act of a desperate man would bring him to this woman, this Balas Ov. All right, she's a witch. That's the translation in English. Necromancy. And what is she doing? She is doing something. They're conjuring up a spirit of Shmuel, because Shaul needs to know what's going to be. And nobody's talking to him. He's lost his nevuah. No, he's got Shmuel is dead. David has run away to Plishtim. He's living abroad, and there's nobody to help him out. And he's desperate. He's absolutely a desperate man. So what does he do? And the irony is, he spent his whole malchus killing out all of these women. And all of a sudden, when he needs one, he has to go looking around the country for somebody to give him a nevuah. And she does. And she produces Shmuel upside down. All right? He comes up, and he's inverted. And he's very annoyed, for obvious reasons. You disturb me from my sleep. What are you doing over here? And all of this story is an incredible, read that story, and it's all part of really the same thing. Shaul, clearly the statement that Shaul was making to the Jewish people is, we have nothing to do with this, because it is connected to Avodah Zarah. But once you get connected to it, you have to play with the circumstance, you have to deal with the consequence of it. And I really feel this is an important sugya to know. All right, and it all came out of this little comment over here of what we daven every day. Kudoshim b'chol yom la'aduch ha'selah. We say that Hashem protects us, hein b'shamayim, v'hein ba'aretz, against the nations on the earth, and b'shamayim, against the heavenly forces which are out there, possibly doing us damage. And this is something which we have the protection of God. It's a remarkable interpretation, and all of that, and that Gemara really fits into to this comment over here. All right, one word in the Perush. And a lot of explanation, but it's fascinating. If you want to take this further, look up the Jewish Encyclopedia on Astrology and Ayin Hara. Very fascinating. You really want to go into this stuff, but it comes with a health warning, just to tell you. Just be careful about it, all right? Government health warning, do not dabble in this information freely. Just keep away from it, but it's really there. I think I'm going to leave it there, but it's something that I think is really worth knowing. It was a bit of a digression, but it was Kedai. It was really something important to understand. When your grandmother says Kanei Nahara, when you hear that, her saying that, even if she's not alive anymore, you always heard that Kanei Nahara, now you realize there's a lot more to it than just, maybe they didn't appreciate what they were saying, but it's really something very, very strange. Very strange, very Jewish, very grey indeed. All right, I'll leave it at that. Mitzvah Shem, next week, Modim and Achlach, we're going to go in the last three brachas. We've done the first three. We're going to do the last three, which we haven't yet covered at all, because a lot of what we've done after that you're already here for. And then after that, we'll probably maybe do a bit of review on what we learned prior. So next week, Modem and Afalot, back to the real world. Right? We had a dabble in the metaphysical world. Now we're going to come back to the real world. Thank you very much.